Good morning. The day 2 years in the making is finally here. On this election day, news analyst Neil Conan gives us his review and a prediction or two. And in a local race, many Hawaii residents may still feel they shouldn't make a choice. Office of Hawaiian Affairs trustee Peter Apo joins us with the reasons why they should and what he makes of the quietly contentious contest that could result in an OHUS shakeup. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Gary Kubota's one-man play Legend of Ko'olau is the true story of one Hawaiian man's resistance to authority and the ongoing inspiration he provides. And Jody Mountain offers instruction in old-school Lomi Lomi, therapy for the mind, body, and spirit all in one.
It's Tuesday, November 8th. Stay here for the conversation. First, this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Several OHA races on the ballot today, yeah?
Right, and sort of been getting a little bit short shrift given the fact that there's been so much stuff
yeah.
Taking our attention and eclipsing it. We're going to talk about that this morning as many people may be, in fact, thinking that, should they not be voting in OHA races?
Exactly.
That's a long-standing conversation. Now, you know, in the last few years, Office of Hawaiian Affairs has had its share of controversies. The letter written by its CEO asking for an opinion from the Secretary of State on the status of the Hawaiian Kingdom, OHA's indirect funding of the Na'iopuni Convention, and its stance on the 30-meter telescope. Today, we're going to find out whether those issues and controversies they fueled have been enough to unseat longtime incumbents and to get many non-Hawaiians who still believe they shouldn't vote in an OHA election to actually make a choice. Peter Apo is an OHA trustee not involved in today's election. He joins us now by phone. Good morning, Peter. Good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Mr. Ann. How are you?
I'm doing all right, thanks, and hope you are too, and hope that the things turn out well, whatever well may be, later on. But as we look at what people are being asked to do today, to go and vote for an OHA election, what do you say to people who still feel that despite, you know, recent pushes to have everyone vote in the OHA election, that they still feel somewhat reticent to do so?
Yeah, well, you know, OHA's been around for 36 years, and it's amazing to me that a lot of people don't feel that we're relevant. We probably haven't done as good a job as we could have in articulating what we do, the mission, and how it impacts everybody in Hawaii. First of all, you know, OHA trustees routinely make important decisions that affect everyone. Probably the latest example is the massive expansion of the Papahana Mokuakea National Marine Monument by President Obama.
And now the stewardship that OHA in part will be responsible for.
Well, more than that, without OHA and the Hawaiian support, that never would have happened. The politics of the situation in Washington, D.C. is that they sought out OHA leaders, Kamala Crabb, mm-hmm. to actually lead an effort so that Hawaiians would become the center of gravity in moving that initiative forward. Secondly, OHA provided, at last count, over $1 million to support and to actually make a difference in attracting the International Congress that came here on marine conservation. First time they've ever come to the United States, and they came to Hawaii. And that was partly connected to the expansion. So the millions of dollars that came into Hawaii as a result of OHA's participation and the incredible public policy statement that was made that positioned the United States as having been able to boast through Hawaii for the largest marine conservation district in the world. Stuff like this goes on all the time with OHA in making decisions. We have a steady presence at the state legislature. Every single year, we have a political advocacy division that lobbies both the state legislature and the Congress. We have an office in Washington, D.C., and a lot of the issues like water rights, public access to beaches, public access to the mountains are all things that totally affect everybody who lives in Hawaii, not just Hawaiians. Mm-hmm. So people are not aware of the deep penetration that we have and the commitment not only to delve in areas of issues that directly benefit Native Hawaiians, but, you know, we are still the people of Aloha, and we care about everyone. So we get engaged in quality of life issues that affect not only Hawaiians, but everyone.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those issues, though, that now may be coming more to the fore if, you know, in fact, you know, Kalii Akina, who wants Haunani Apoliana's seat, and if Mililani Trask were to get Bob Lindsay's seat. How much of a shakeup would that cause in terms of some of the things that you've just been talking about?
I don't know. If the incumbents retain their seats, obviously we will continue to progress in the same direction, on those issues. If they don't retain the seat, then I can't second guess what the new trustees might want to advocate.
There has been some suggestion over many years that, you know, OHA works in certain ways, but not in all ways for all Hawaiian people. You say, no, it's like not only for all Hawaiian people, it's for all people, period. Why do you think there's such a gap in there, that there seems to be so many controversies that pepper OHA continually?
Well, first of all, the image of OHA and what people understand OHA to represent and to be is largely driven by mainstream media. Mainstream media is only attracted to OHA if Hawaiians are arguing and fighting with each other. And that's the only way we get headlines, and they tend to be pretty spectacular headlines.
We've seen some of those in the past. Yeah,
36 years of that's the image people have at OHA. They have no clue, really, and I don't blame them. And again, I think OHA has to take a certain amount of responsibility in our messaging. You know, that we haven't been able to show people the part of the iceberg that's submerged that is significantly impacts lives of everyone in Hawaii, not just one.
Knowing that part of the iceberg that we don't see, that you've been talking about for a while now, is also partly the responsibility, as you say, of OHA to get out. What do you think OHA needs to do much, much better to be able to change its image and also to engage the public in general?
I think trustees have to take that, Juliana, the responsibility, a little bit more. I can't say we take it seriously, but I think we have to develop a much larger cost center within the Office of Hawaiian Affairs in order to fashion a public communications program that is not so incestuous. A lot of our communications are directed only at Hawaiians. We need to broaden that reach on those, especially when we're talking about issues that affect everyone. And I hope to advocate that very strongly in the next round of talks after this election.
Pirapoa, as you mentioned, that there should be more responsibility on the part of the trustees. What would be a first issue on your list that you think everybody needs to know more about OHA's activities?
Just the way we work. People don't realize, you know, we operate a $650 million trust fund. OHA money is colorblind. You don't have to be Hawaiian to be a provider of services to Hawaiians. We, in fact, don't provide, tend to not want to provide direct services. Instead, we contract third parties who don't have to be Hawaiian, healthcare, education, culture and the arts, business loans, home loans, communications, research, political ad, Native rights, historic preservation. I mean, you name it, we do it. Finance, architecture, development, research, economics, communications, banking, planning, all of that. Millions of dollars go out. And a lot of it goes to non-Hawaiians, in the business community, because our measures of success and the award of a contract is not measured by the blood quantum of the applicant or the provider. It's by them being able to determine that they will be effective in delivering the service And as long as the service goes to Native Hawaiians, we are allowed to do that.
And Peter, we have to go in just a minute, but has there been enough accountability with what programs you've just mentioned, that great long shopping list, to be able to engender a lot of public support and appreciation?
My response to that is Google OHA.org, and you will have days and days of reading of everything we do, the budget, the financing, the programs. I mean, it goes on and on and on. We have done a really good job in launching a website that goes deep and wide. People just don't take the time to go do that. You know, they want to read it in the front page of the Star Advertiser.
All right. Well, perhaps they'll take a little time now. Thank you so much for making time for us today. I know it's a very, very busy day for you.
Yes. Mahalo. Aloha.
Aloha. Peter Apo is an elected trustee of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and a community thought leader. He says his motto is "All Hawaii Stand Together," and that it means all people living in Hawaii working together are essential to the health of the community. Hawaii's diversity is its strength, according to Peter Apo, and we'll see how that shows up in today's election. You're listening to The Conversation on this election day on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a 19th century legend of one man's struggle against authority. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Umurokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohangai.
As you may have heard, there's an election being held today, and you may also have heard that some of the races being voted on are rather contentious. We won't be addressing any of those in today's backyard quiz, but we will be looking at a historic vote that was also very contentious. That vote was a referendum where voters expressed their support or opposition for a specific issue, and it may be hard to imagine, but the debate over this issue was even longer than the 2016 election debate. In fact, it was years longer. That issue was Hawaii's statehood, and before residents voted on the statehood issue in 1959, there had been decades of debate both across Washington and in Hawaii, and in the end, the vote was not as close as today's presidential election is likely to be. For today's quiz, we want to know what percentage of voters chose yes on Hawaii's statehood referendum in 1959. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
A 19th century standoff between a Hawaiian cowboy and an armed force sent to take him and his son to Molokai's leper colony is the stuff of theater for playwright Gary Kubota, whose Legend of Ko'olau is back for a Hawaii performance after a mainland tour. Gary's with us in our studio with some reflections on the way mainland audiences respond to his true life adventure story. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning.
This is, at one level, this is a story of a rebel, and Americans do like their rebels, don't they?
Yes, he was a cowboy outlaw. I don't think he planned on being that, but circumstances forced him into it.
And what were the circumstances?
Well, the circumstance was that he and his son had leprosy and went into Kalalau Valley in the remote section of Kauai, North Kauai, mm-hmm. to live out their days. And a deputy sheriff didn't want that to happen and wanted to force them to go to Kalapapa. And he warned them that if he came in, he'd kill him.
Why did he, you know, since they were off in their own isolation, why did he want to take them out of that?
I think there was a tinge of political ambition in it all. He was married to a missionary woman, descendant, and there was a certain sense of entitlement, and he didn't like the way Kolau defied the what were at that time leprosy laws.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the what we refer to as authority in this story was actually just right after the overthrow, so kind of questionable authority, yeah?
Yeah, and they were stepping up that particular end of forced migration into, forced isolation at Kalapapa.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the people, like Kolau, you know, they'd grown up under the monarchy, and their archival indications that Kolau's descendant was actually a guard, an aupuni, during Kaahumanu's time, during the Christianity time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he was closely aligned with the monarchy and with Christianity as well.
So there's a political undercurrent to this that, well, I wondered, for example, how mainland audiences, how much understanding they would have brought to that particular aspect of the story.
I found out that they really loved it. We had more than 600 people attending the play in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still hearing from them through Facebook about their reaction to the play, and they're encouraging a lot of people here to see it. You know, what happened was that we toured Los Angeles, Berkeley, and Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
And more people in California now have seen the play than people in Honolulu.
Well, it's got some irony to all the more reason to bring it home, right?
Yes, that's what I'm thinking too. You know, we had one showing at Hawaii Theater. It was one of the first showings.
And we talked at that time,
right?
Yeah, but since then, you know, the whole idea. What's interesting to me is the whole idea of bringing it to audiences that are not familiar with Kalaupapa, the monarchy, the overthrow. They had to be, California, West Coast audiences had to be a lot less familiar, certainly, than we are.
Yeah, I think there was a sense of empathy and a sense of feeling. A lot of people are minorities or sons and daughters of grandsons and daughters of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sense, you know, of dispossession, sense of bringing out the humanity in the situation,
mm-hmm.
and also the sense of looking at one man standing up for what he believes isn't right.
Yeah. Well, the, you know, American literature, American culture is full of admiration for the lone hero, the rebel, the he who defies authority, right?
And that's correct. And, you know, it wouldn't have been a battle if they just walked away, because
yeah.
he wasn't really looking for a battle. I mean, he was looking just to stay in Kalalau Valley.
Yeah.
And once they understood that, they left.
So he did live out his days in Kalalau Valley?
He lived out his days, and he died in Kalalau Valley along with his son. And after about 3 years, Pi'ilani, his wife, walked out of the valley and told the story of how they lived in the valley and died. And she lived back talking about 1912, 1914, she died.
And yet a deputy had been killed in the original standoff, right?
Yeah, so he killed a deputy, and then they actually sent an army to try and capture him.
Yeah.
They declared martial law on Kauai,
yeah.
sections of Kauai, and they brought more than 30 soldiers along with a Krupp cannon on a ship. And then that was in addition to more than 20 deputies, and they stormed up the valley to try and force him out of his cave. He was a crack shot. He was a foreman at one of the ranches, and they just picked on the wrong guy.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's an amazing story, and it's you know, there's so many aspects of it that have a universality, which has to be what you learned touring the show.
Yes, and I think that I also met actually some descendants of his wife, Pilani, and also of his sister, Naholopapa. And they were familiar with certain aspects that weren't in the history. And they basically told me that the story that I'd written was the most accurate rendition they've seen or heard about, and it was awesome. So they loved the play, and I felt really, really good about that.
In the background of this, the whole idea of being transported to Kalaupapa, which is what they were the armed group was trying to do. Kalaupapa in those days, you can't sugarcoat it. It was a leper colony, right?
Right, and it was a leper colony filled with minorities. There weren't a lot of white people there, the Hawaiians, if you translated what they described, you could translate it to call it the living grave.
Yeah.
And that's what it was at that time.
Weren't a lot of white people there because why?
They were
taken somewhere else. They were given a more privileged.
From talking to people, and these are like anecdotes.
Yeah.
If someone, say a woman had leprosy and she was white, she would be put into a house.
Up in the attic.
In the valley or up in the attic or something like that, and she'd live out her remaining years there very quietly. And that was the same for someone who was...
So race and class privilege played a role in who got sent to...
It did.
Kalaupapa.
It did, unfortunately. And, I think that because of that, there was a lack of humanity in it. At one certain point during the monarchy, they allowed kukuas to go to Kalaupapa with the persons who were sick. But during Ko'olau's time, they had done away with that. And so his wife, who didn't have leprosy, couldn't go with him if they had gone to Kalaupapa Molokai. And that was one of the issues that prevailed in terms of the family sticking together.
At its heart, Gary, it's a human story. And it deserves a much wider viewing, doesn't it? Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gary Kubota is the author of The Legend of Ko'olau, which will be performed Saturday, November 19th at 7:30 at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater. And you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Ka nani au pokalani, me ke hae pokalana kila. Kuie, kuie ha, I kani kani ka puku vai. Kuie, kuie ha, I kani kani ka puku vai.
Hawaii Public Radio gratefully acknowledges Rachel Hayes of Hana, Mark and Donna Arroyos of Honolulu, and Jacob Andy of Pearl City for their recent membership gifts. And thank you to all of our listeners for your support. If you've yet to join HPR, become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. Plans for a transit-oriented development include about 39,000 units. In addition to rail proximity, they may also come with an additional fee for schools. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so we've got a 4-mile stretch. Lots more people who will be potentially moving into that area, so they'll have access to rail. We've been told that transit-oriented development is all part of the package, and now we're finding out that package may also include about $9,400 per unit for developers to go to that school fee. What does that mean for developers in assessing whether or not they're actually going to build all this affordable housing?
Well, that's the concern. And as you've heard all along, developers have complained that there has to be some sort of trade-off if they're going to provide affordable housing as well as their normal units. And we're talking about a stretch from Kalihi to Ala Moana. That's right in the urban core. So it's anticipated, as you indicated, 39,000 new residents. Well, if you do the math, that's about 9,000 students. And if that's the case, a draft analysis from the Department of Ed says you're going to need 6 more elementary schools and probably 1.5, I'm not sure how they came up with this formula, 1.5 middle and high schools in order to handle all those students. So they say the only way to accommodate that is to have an impact fee that would be assessed on those developers. And you're right, $9,400 for each unit if they don't provide land for those schools. So it's a decision the developers will have to make.
Is there also another way for them to be able to provide schools, or is there some other trade-off that we haven't heard about?
Well, certainly if they can provide land, that would take care of the problem. The DOE is trying to cover 100% of the land cost plus 10% of whatever building expenses. They could also be renovating existing facilities. The legislature would have to pick up the rest of the tab. Now, this is a 2007 law. We've had this impact fee for a while now. We're using it in Central Maui, in West Maui, leeward Oahu. But now that rail is coming into town, presumably, we're going to have to deal with this stretch. The concern is, are you sacrificing affordable housing? And folks at our reporter, Noel Fujii, talked to said, maybe there's another way. Maybe we can make an exemption for affordable housing. We could waive things for those affordable dwelling units that everyone's talked about. These are the kind of things that the city is going to have to decide. Excuse me, the city with the Department of Education.
If not, then presumably some of those fees are going to wind up in the cost of the units or in what they're going to be charged for later down the line. Somehow that those fees would have to be recaptured.
Right. The developers will either pay that fee when they apply for a building permit, or they're going to pass it on to the first owners. As somebody in Noel's story said, someone is going to have to pay for this. The money is going to have to come from somewhere. And one possibility, by the way, is to build vertically because, as you know, land in the urban core is quite precious.
So we talked about that once before, schools in the sky.
Yes, exactly. But it really is the only way that we can do that. You can't have those wide complexes that we're so used to in so many schools around the state.
That might make the commute for some kids really attractive. Okay, we're going to focus back on the election. We'll be talking to you tomorrow. Have a good one, Chad.
Thanks, Beth, and you too.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting singer-songwriter-pianist Peter Sincotti in two shows nightly, November 16th through 20th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
As we await results this election day, there's one thing you already know. This political cycle has been different. The two most unpopular presidential candidates in history and a campaign that reflected those differences between the two had racism, sexism, and xenophobia all playing major parts. Huge numbers have already turned out to vote early or by mail, and if estimates can be believed, we may see record numbers by the end of the day. On this Tuesday, as usual, news analyst Neil Conan joins us from his Macnut Farm on the Big Island. And Neil, can you believe that we're actually here at Election Day at last?
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, it's interesting. I went back to look at my notes for the conversations we had a year ago when I was among so many so-called experts who dismissed Donald Trump as a sideshow. Now, win or lose today, he has not only proved wrong, but he has transformed American politics, transformed the Republican Party, and accelerated changes to transform the American electorate and with it the electoral map.
You know, and throughout the primaries and now in the general election, it seems that every conversation begins with Donald Trump.
Well, Hillary Clinton certainly hopes that holds. She's tried to make this race a referendum on Donald Trump. And for much of the summer, he cooperated by saying, you know, one crazy thing after another, getting into Twitter wars with a Gold Star family or a federal judge. But since his absolute low point, which was the release of that Billy Bush video where he bragged about groping women, well, he finally showed some discipline or had it imposed on him these past few weeks, and the polls tightened.
FBI Director James Comey also seemed to help him cast the race as a referendum on Hillary Clinton when he decided to go public with the discovery of the emails. Another thing about this campaign that's been different, and that last-minute intervention by the FBI that was seen by many as interference.
An impression reinforced this past Sunday when Director Comey issued another letter that basically said, well, you know, never mind, no news here. Millions of people cast their ballots over the days between letter one and letter two, many of whom might have reasonably concluded that there must have been something pretty serious in those emails for the FBI to take that unprecedented step and step in so late. So now, no matter who wins today, there are going to be questions from both sides for Director Comey about the way he handled this and about the flood of leaks from an FBI that suddenly seems highly partisan.
Can we go back for a minute to something you just mentioned there, that the millions who voted early? You know, I was stunned to see a statistic earlier this morning. You know, back in 2000, just 16 years ago, the total number of votes cast in the state of Florida was 5.8 million. This year, 6.4 million voted early in Florida. Now, I mean, Florida has more people than it did 16 years ago, but wow.
Yeah. You know, the number most people remember from 2000 in Florida is 537. That's the difference that gave George W. Bush the presidency over Al Gore. And Florida may turn out to be just as pivotal this year. But let's get back to that later. The early vote, which will turn out to be the majority of votes in Florida and Nevada, all the votes in mail-in states like Washington and Oregon, above a third, maybe 40% nationwide, this has changed the way campaigns advertise, the way they travel, the way they organize. And let's point out another difference this year. One campaign is the most technically sophisticated we have ever seen. They use data to identify every single possible supporter in swing states, then send out legions of volunteers and staffers to talk to those people in person or on the phone and get them out to vote. In Barack Obama's campaign, this ground game was credited with one or two extra points. This year, Donald Trump has completely disdained this approach. He said it was overrated. That goes back to his race in the primaries. Now, he won those with big rallies. He won by dominating the news cycle on TV and with social media. So we'll see today, you know, which of these two campaigns outperforms their polls.
If we go to the early voting numbers, it looks like Hillary Clinton and the Democrats may have already done that in Nevada. I mean, polls are showing the presidential race close, but most of the votes there have already been cast. And an analysis of who's voted says the number of registered Democrats over the number of registered Republicans, that shows that Clinton is well ahead.
Yeah, and John Walston, who's the most respected analyst in Nevada, went so far as to declare Donald Trump is already dead and buried there, in no small part due to the huge turnout of Hispanics this year. This goes to the theory that this election was decided on the first day when Donald Trump rode the escalator down in Trump Tower and talked about Mexican immigrants as rapists and drug dealers and talked about the wall he would make Mexico pay for. Those are comments that Mexican-Americans may make Donald Trump pay for in Nevada and Colorado today. Puerto Ricans and Dominicans and Venezuelans and Haitians and even Cubans may make him pay with their votes in Florida. This is one of those areas where Donald Trump has accelerated trends already underway. He energized Hispanics as no one ever has before. For the first time in history, their turnout will reflect their numbers, and they could very well make the difference, not just this year, but even more later, as the fastest growing element of the American population.
At the same time, Trump's chances really rely on historic turnouts of less well-educated whites, which represents a dwindling percentage of the population now, as you've just been talking about.
Yeah, less well-educated men in particular. 4 years ago, everybody remembers the famous autopsy the Republican National Committee produced after Mitt Romney's loss, which concluded that Republicans had to find a way to appeal to women, to African Americans, to young people, and to Hispanics if they ever wanted to win the White House. Now, that analysis looks more accurate than ever before after a campaign where Donald Trump alienated every single one of those groups, you know, and maybe for generations to come.
I want you to hang on there for a second because, you know, Hillary Clinton has had some major problems appealing to younger voters, too. I mean, remember how many supported Bernie Sanders in the primary, certainly in Hawaii, and they don't seem to support Hillary in anything close to the percentages of other supporters.
That's true enough, but they're not supporting Donald Trump or the Republicans either. Some are staying home. Some are voting third party for Libertarian Gary Johnson or for Jill Stein of the Green Party.
Neither of those two, though, look to set to break through and establish a viable third party as a force in American politics, despite all the stuff that we've seen.
Absolutely. No, Libertarian support got close to double digits during the summer. That's now collapsed. They may not make the 5% threshold where the party receives federal recognition. Dr. Stein and the Greens never got above 2% or so. They both have to be very disappointed. Kevin McMullen, who's running as a conservative Mormon alternative to Donald Trump, he searched in Utah for a little while. Now that looks pretty safe for Donald Trump. He might pull away some votes in Arizona, McMullen might, which is one of the factors that makes Arizona pretty interesting this year.
A little earlier, we talked about perhaps, you know, transforming the electoral map once safe Republican states like Arizona, what you were just talking about. And maybe even Georgia could be in play, along with the once reliable Democratic states in the Midwest. What gives with this?
Well, you know, that coalition of college-educated whites, African-Americans, and Hispanics turning some red states purple or even blue. Barack Obama won Virginia twice. It looks like Hillary Clinton will win it today. On the other hand, older, whiter Iowa, Obama won that twice, and it looks set to go into the Trump column today.
Okay, so here's the hot seat question. What do you think happens today?
Well, I think we're going to find out early. North Carolina is raising toss-up. Clinton has a slight edge in Florida. Now, there's no plausible way for Trump to win without both of those states. Same goes for Ohio, a bit less so for New Hampshire. Both of those are close, too. Both campaigns invested heavily in Pennsylvania. Now, if Trump loses one or two or three, even four of those, he's going to start having to bank on really long shots like Michigan, Minnesota, or Wisconsin. Both campaigns spent a lot of late time in Michigan. Excuse me. The last batch of opinion polls gave Clinton a lead of 3 to 4 points. I think the Democratic advantage in the ground game gives her one or two more in the swing states. I think she's going to hold all of that blue wall in the upper Midwest. I think she wins Florida and New Hampshire, probably North Carolina, maybe even Ohio. So I don't think this is going to be close in the Electoral College. You need 270 win. I think Clinton gets 320, maybe more.
We got to go here in just a minute, but I got to ask you about the Senate. Democrats need to pick four seats to win control. If Vice President Kaine can break the 50-50 tie, five to win control outright.
Well, I think they get it. They're going to hold on to Harry Reid's seat in Nevada, so no Democratic losses. Easy pickup in Illinois. Probables in Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania. That's their four right there. Plus, they got a shot in North Carolina, maybe even a shot in Missouri.
Okay, yes or no? What about Marco Rubio holding on to his seat?
Looks like he does. Some anti-Trump Hispanics may split their ballots and vote for Rubio over Democrat Patrick Murphy. So remember those 17 presidential candidates in the Republican Party? Marco Rubio is the only one who may get to raise his hand in victory tonight on Election Day.
And really quickly, what about the House?
Always a long shot for the Democrats. They had to win 30 to flip it. I think the break-even point is probably about 13. But even at that, it's going to make Paul Ryan's life miserable as Speaker of the House of Representatives.
All right. We're going to talk with you again tomorrow along with your buddy Ken Rudin, who we're going to have back too.
Good. I'll talk to you tomorrow, Beth Ann.
All right. And just one thing before you go. Did you vote?
I've always liked that, you know, ritual of going down to vote on Election Day. So as soon as we hang up, I'm headed down to the Kohala High School cafeteria.
Yeah, me too. I like that ritual. Talk to you tomorrow.
I'll talk to you tomorrow, Beth Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, featuring pianist Sean Kennard and music by Wagner, Liszt, and Sibelius. Ward Stair will conduct this Sunday at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Here in Hawaii, like everywhere else, we have some big issues to solve. Among these are the lack of food self-sufficiency, disenfranchised youth, poverty, and poor health. Wouldn't it be amazing if one group was working to solve all these issues? Well, this group exists, and it's funded by the Hawaii Community Foundation. It's on a 5-acre organic farm in Lualualei Valley, and it's called Mala'ai Opio. They teach sustainable farming practices to our youth. Intermediate school kids make their own implements. They pound poi and learn to grow vegetables. High schoolers develop ways to sell their crops and spread the word about organic food. And college students can get official credit for studying related topics like Native Hawaiian nutrition, organic farming methods, and entrepreneurship. Using traditional Hawaiian ways, Ma'o teaches poor kids to grow good food and then they sell it. Best of all, you eat good food, you get good health. You can't argue with that. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And now back to today's Backyard Quiz, where we looked at an important historic vote, Hawaii's statehood referendum held on June 27, 1959. For years, opposition both here and in the U.S. Congress made statehood unattainable. John A. Burns, a Democratic Party delegate and Hawaii's governor at the time, said the reasons why Hawaii didn't achieve statehood for so long lie not in Congress, but in Hawaii. However, Hawaii delegate Elizabeth Farrington didn't agree. She blamed Lyndon Johnson and his coalition of Southern Democrats who voted against statehood 22 times. In the end, the referendum passed with an overwhelming margin on all islands. 93% of the 140,000 votes cast were in favor of statehood. That vote generated the highest proportional voter turnout in Hawaii's recorded history, which some would love to emulate today. That's today's quiz, and I think we've got a winner.
We do. Shannon Duffy got it right, and congratulations. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Jody Mountain is a dancer, choreographer, and teacher who is a lifelong student of what she calls movement dynamics. She's about to lead a workshop into the ancient art of lomi-lomi, also known as kahuna body work. And in her way of teaching, it's far more than massage. It's a discipline that integrates mind, body, and spirit. And she's on the line with us from her Maui studio. Good morning, Jody.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on your program.
Sure. You make a distinction between what you're teaching and what is usually understood to be lomi-lomi massage, right?
Yes. Well, the fact is that lomi-lomi, the word just means to massage, and there are many, many different lineages of lomi-lomi, mm-hmm. many different ways to approach the body. And in ancient times, you know, each family on each island would have a different specialty of healing mm-hmm. passed down through the family, and some might be for broken bones, or another might be for babies that were breech birth, or for all aspects of pregnancy. And so when you had different things to address, you would go and seek out those experts in those fields. So this type of lomi-lomi, in contrast to the kind that was integrated into the community like that, this one was only practiced in the temple space. You would have been worked on for 10 hours, up to 15 days, 24 hours a day, with anywhere from 1 to 5 kahuna working with your system.
Wow.
So this particular kind is from ancient, the indigenous people of Hawaii before the Polynesian invasion.
So that's way more intensive than anything that any of us might have experienced, yeah?
I would think so in this day and age, yeah. Mm-hmm.
At the heart is what? The healing power of touch?
Well, the original name for this work is actually Ke Ala Hoku, which means pathway to the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's based on the foundational concept that we are all just one being. Our body, mind, spirit, emotions, cellular processes are all located in the one place, our consciousness even. And this is designed to touch the consciousness of ourselves. If you can imagine that each body part, each finger, each toe has a consciousness, has a life. Each cell in those parts has a life. Each electron, each atom has more than just life force. It has an actual consciousness, an awareness, an awakeness of life itself. And so this work was designed to actually touch that in the practitioner, and in that way we open up the doorway for that life to be recognized and to rise in the receiver. So what you end up with is someone who is more deeply connected to their origins, the origins of life force in our bodies. We're mostly life force. We're less than 1% our thoughts and ideas and knowledge, and we are actually more like 99% cellular processes and these different worlds within worlds, universes within universes of consciousness that live inside of us.
And yet most of us remain entirely unaware, yeah?
Yeah. Well, we live from our minds, and it's not our fault. We're taught that what we see and hear and think is what's true. And actually, science has proven that we only see, for one thing, 1% of the visual spectrum, the visual electromagnetic spectrum, rather. And 99% of whatever is in your environment right now, wherever you are, you can't see, because the cones in our eyes can only see 1%. And so I would take this to another kauna, another level of awareness, which is I would apply that to our perception. Most of us don't perceive 99% of what is here. And in this work, it's directly correlated to how much we are in connection with the life inside of us will equal how much we're in connection with the life outside of us.
Well, Jody, I'm sure that those who would argue that what we see is what we need to see and eliminates what we don't need to see. What's the effect on people of that kind of expansion of their awareness?
Well, it helps us to meet subconscious and unconscious parts of ourselves that perhaps got buried and perhaps are crying out to be free. So all of us would have different experiences of patterns that keep recurring in our life that hold us back, perhaps from what we perceive to be happiness or freedom of expression or just different ways of being fulfilled and satisfied in our life. And so if we wonder why we're always stopped or feeling limited or feeling embarrassed or feeling shy or whatever our different forms of that are, forms of limitation, by being aware of more of the consciousness in us, we actually become more aware of our subconscious and unconscious mind and what is actually running us in the background, not what we choose consciously, not what we see, not the 1%, but the rest that's actually fueling our actions.
Jody, what kind of things do people say to you having been through this?
Having been through the workshop?
Well, yeah.
There's a lot of people who have said, I feel a lot less fear in my life, a lot less fear of outer circumstances, of disaster or, you know, anxiety, let's say, of the future. Oh, my God, what's going to happen? People feel less a victim of circumstance and less a victim of their lives, and they become more cognizant that they are life itself. They are life is pouring through us, and that we have the ability to communicate with that life both inside of us and outside of us. And that's really a sense of empowerment that, you know, we are connected with all of nature. And not to bring politics into this, but it's like the people at Standing Rock are aware that the life inside of them is communicating with the life in the water, and they're able to stand up for that and say, yes, this is true.
Well, Jody, we've got to run, but thanks very much for that, giving us that kind of introduction. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Jody Mountain will preside over an ancient Lomi Lomi Nui training retreat that begins this Saturday and runs through November 18th at Laulima Farm in Kipahulu, Maui. And you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Bethann, I voted early, and I'm sort of regretting it because I would have liked to do what you and Neil were talking about, which is take part in the whole ritual of voting in your neighborhood on election day.
Yeah, there's something about that, you know. But then again, there's also an equal argument to doing it when you have time to be truly, you know, thoughtful and to do it in your own time when you do it by mail and can sit at your kitchen table.
Yeah.
Or if you just walk in after you've already made your notes. But many people will have done that today, too, when they walk in. The nice thing about walking in today is seeing your neighbors. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, here's to seeing lots of our neighbors at the polling places, and we hope you have a good election day. We're going to be back with you tomorrow. And we're going to get some bookend conversation from both Neil Conan and Ken Rudin.
And we'll look to a documentary about the effort to preserve Bhutan's cultural heritage.
And in the meantime, as always, you can be in touch with us either through email, which is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can call our talkback line and leave us your comments in your own voice. And please leave us your name and the town from which you're calling to. That number is 808-792-8217.
If you missed any of this show or want a past show, you can find them on the Conversation page under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Go vote. See you tomorrow.